This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, my friend? How are you?
Chilling, man. As per usual. How about yourself?
I can't complain. I'm pretty tired. Right now is about 10:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday the 6th. This episode should be released on Sunday for Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day.
Any mothers listening.
You got any plans for Mother's Day?
Unfortunately, I don't. Well, I do, actually. My mother lives in a different state, in Virginia, so I'm going to my girlfriend's family's house and celebrating Mother's Day there, but I'm sending my mom flowers.
And spoiler stuff. Alert.
And, hopefully she doesn't coming get out until Sunday anyway. So
Will the flowers get there first, or will the episode drop first?
I don't know. That's a good question.
You know,
if the flowers don't get there before she listens to the episode, I'll get a
happy Mother's Day.
I'll file a complaint.
I actually have some interesting plans. My mom also lives in a different state, but that state happens to be New Jersey, so it's not very far. She had the bright idea, since we're all vaccinated now, to go do something. So she wanted to go to Atlantic City. Even though my mom doesn't gamble or drink or like any of that, she just wanted to do something fun and different, you know. And God bless her, because I love Atlantic City. As like depressing and weird as it is, I like being in a casino and like drinking and, you know, playing craps or roulette or whatever.
I didn't realize that the casinos were open.
Yeah, not only are they open, but the weekend after I'm going, they're opening 100%. So they're going to be at 100% capacity. Of course, you still have to wear your mask and stuff like that. But I'm actually kind of interested in going and seeing what is a casino like, you know, at the tail end of like a pandemic. You know, like what's the deal? Are they going to put up plastic dividers in between like the spaces at the craps table? Or is it like going to be where you can't, I don't know. Like, how does drinking work? Because part of my favorite, like, pastime of going to a casino isn't the gambling. It's just, like, being able to drink as much as you like, you know, and you don't have to pay for it, kind of. So that part is super fun.
Well, I wear a mask in Atlantic City. I was wearing a mask in Atlantic City before COVID-19, and I recommend it to everyone. Yeah, I mean, it's Atlantic City. It's a gross place.
Yeah, it's a sad place.
It is very sad. I had maybe the saddest family vacation there when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. I was probably
that's not the time to go to Atlantic City.
It was before. It was like my first experience there, and it was just so gross. We were walking on the boardwalk, and my mom called it the evil boardwalk. That was her name for it. We had a trip to Atlantic City and in Wildwood. I think she might have called the Wildwood Boardwalk the evil boardwalk.
I kind of like Wildwood, but yeah.
It was too many gweeds.
Well, you know, I grew up around them, so they don't bother
me. I know,
me
too. Me too. But my mom's not from New York. She's from Virginia, so she's... It's like a
different world.
Joey and Nuncio walking down with their wife beaters, yelling at their fucking girl, Marie, get the fuck over here. Hey. I mean, that's what I grew up with.
Yeah.
In high school and college. That was people who were surrounding me. That's how I ended up so smart and able to deliver podcast stuff. All right.
Good transition.
So, last episode, we did an episode on Russia Russia's plan to clone an army of ancient Scythian warriors. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a fun thing to do. Obviously, that's just a goofy conspiracy thing that kind of circulated the web last week. So we used that off as a jumping point to actually talk about what a Scythian was, because that's what they were claiming that Russia was going to do. They were going to clone these ancient horseback warriors and somehow put them on the front line in the Ukraine. But
or so that's what dailymail.co.uk told them.
The fourth largest newspaper in England said that, or the UK. And we've been concentrating on Eastern Europe, specifically the conflict in Russia and Ukraine, and we've been trying to also dive into the history and explain things like the identity politics that are going on today, as well as the formation of the state and stuff like that. And we use that as a jumping off point to talk about Russia before there was a state. So specifically the Eurasian steppe. And what made the Eurasian steppe very interesting is that it was just very open grassland that ran from Mongolia to Manchuria, and stretched through modern day Russia and all the way into the Great Hungarian Plains. And what was special about it is that it inspired a lot of movement, like not inspired movement, like get up and move, do something. Like it literally, like the way that the geography made you move, like it you didn't really settle there because it was just wide open plains, just wide open grasslands. We kept on using the analogy, comparing it to Game of Thrones, because, I mean, that's what people who talk about history do now. They compare to make it understandable to other people. They use Game of Thrones as the analogy. So we compared it to the Dothraki Sea. But the people who lived in this area were nomadic horseback people. Like the Scythians, who we were concentrating on, but there was also other groups like the Sarmatians and the Huns and eventually the Mongols.
So the Dothraki, basically.
The Dothraki, the people that the Dothraki are based off. But the ultimate point of that episode was to give you an idea of what that region of the world was like prior to anything that we would like consider Russian, before there were these medieval states that started appearing, and obviously way before the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire. It was a lot of horseback people who were running and raiding and killing, fucking and drinking and whoring,
like cracking skulls and cracking skulls.
But since the steppe was so open, and since the Eurasian steppe stretches so far, so we're talking about something that connects
continents.
It makes Asia Eurasia.
Yeah.
It's a big, it's a giant superhighway.
Yeah,
it's a giant superhighway that it always had a very large movement of different tribes going mainly from east to west, and they were migrating west because the more east you go in the steppe, the less moisture you get from the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, the grass is literally greener on the other side. Like, it's a better ecosystem for agriculture and things like that. The more west you go, the more east you go in the steppe, it's dry and cold.
Yeah.
And that's why you always see these invasions in Europe. Now, on this episode, what we're trying to focus on are the origins of the Slavic people. Typically, when historians are talking about Slavic people, they're talking about three different groups. They're talking about the Western Slavs, who would be people like the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Polaks, basically the people who settled in Central Europe. And then the Southern Slavs, who were the people who settled in the Balkans, so, you know, Serbians and Bulgarians. And then the Eastern Slavs, who, you know, we're mainly going to focus on. That would be the Ukrainians, the Belarusians, and the Russians. Now, going back to the Eurasian steppe, and this is a murky history, All history that goes back this far is pretty murky. But the popular consensus is that Slavs started to appear around 700 AD or so. It could have been earlier. It could have been a little bit later. But I think that is kind of an estimate based on
a ballpark.
Ballpark range.
Yeah.
They started showing up around 700 AD or so. And the different tribes traveling across this superhighway, in this case, the southern plains of the Pontic Caspian Steppe, which is the plains that are north of the Black Sea.
Right.
They started to funnel out in what is now Ukraine, and they settled around a riverbank, the riverbank of the Dnieper.
Is it Dnieper or Dnieper?
It's Dnieper. I think it's Dnieper, but I could be pronouncing that incorrectly.
Dnieper? I thought it was Dnieper. Maybe the D is silent, like Django.
maybe it is. We'll call it the Dnieper, just so if someone calls us out for a mispronunciation, they can blame you.
Okay, cool.
No, because I always get blamed for that.
Yeah, I'll take the blame.
You mispronounced that guy's name.
It's Dnieper.
It's Dnieper, you idiot.
Duh.
Well, I even do a podcast, you fucking idiots. You can't even pronounce
words.
Russian,
can't pronounce
Ukrainian
words.
Rivers, you fucking idiots. But this river, it rises from the upland region in northwest central Russia, and it flows down through, you know, what we, you know, modern Belarus and into Ukraine, and then eventually goes into the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first major state there is established on the bank of that river, and the state is called the Kievan Rus. Here are the two primary reasons what makes this area like a spot where humans can kind of flourish. It has natural tributaries that facilitate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to move people around. Most importantly, this area is connected with the Black Sea, which linked Rus with the Eastern Roman Empire.
Right, the Byzantine Empire, right. Mm.
But also in this area, the soil produces extremely high agriculture yields, which yep. allowed this area to support a large population. It's called Chernozem, which means black soil or black earth in Russian.
Right, right. There's and it's also just like the climate there too. So there's like a long enough growing season there to allow, you know, for crops to be grown really easily. Because, you know, the further out you go, like as you said, the further east you go, the drier, the colder, et cetera, that it gets. But in this particular region, you know, it was the season for crop yield is long enough where they can actually get, you know, a really good yield out of their growth. And, you know, even till today, this region is like basically the breadbasket, not only just for Russia, but for actually a lot of Europe too, still. And then this being that you can basically grow food and stockpile a shit ton for cold winters, which was very important for that region. And then you can either have it as wheat in a silo, or you can make vodka. And vodka was a particularly good way to sell the excess produce that they had, obviously for a substantial profit. So that's kind of where vodka comes from. Interesting fact, the word vodka comes from the Russian word for water.
I did not know that.
Well, speaking of water, I think you mentioned this already. They have a lot of tributaries in Russia, a lot of rivers, right? And like you said, it helps the Russians grow more food, you know, because they can irrigate more land and, you know, they can also use it as a way to, you know, do trade, right? So Kiev, which is the main city, and the Kievan Rus had more people, you know, than any other city in Western Europe during its height in the 11th century, and other cities like Novgorod, they also grew pretty big too. And all of those rivers that they had served this purpose for them. And the purpose was that, you know, it was literally a waterway, right? So the cities of Kiev and Novgorod were basically on the way between like the Viking people and the Byzantines, which were obviously two of the bigger trading powers, you know, in the 10th and 11th century. So the rivers basically turned the whole region into one giant trade route, right? And the Rus basically grew really rich off of this. But they were also exposed to a lot of stuff. So they were exposed to a lot of cultural ideas, religions, politics, and a whole lot of violence. We can probably get to that later, though. Yeah. But before I get to... Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Just comparing this part of Eastern Europe with the rest of Russia, because we're going to try to get down into some more complicated, debated parts of this history. But comparing this region with like the rest of Russia, like Russia has throughout its entire history, it's had a huge scarcity problem, still does, because all of this natural resources are up north,
right?
And it's like Siberia,
right?
And like they're growing, like compared to you know, these black earth regions, most of Russia has really short growing seasons,
right?
And it's, they don't have enough produce to really, they don't produce enough yields to like, to have a bad year, you know, like once they have a bad year, they're fucked.
Right. All right. So let's get back to the Kievan Rus. So like, how did the first Slavic state like come into existence?
I mean, naturally when you're dealing with history where there's a lot to interpret, the origin story always becomes a political debate. An exercise in creating some type of national identity.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to pinpoint the origins of the Slavs in general. I think some of the earliest stories we have about the Slavs, not even the Kievan Rus, but just the Slavs themselves, you know, they start when the Slavs had already split into three separate groups, you know? So it's kind of hard to get the story straight when you don't even have the start of the story.
Well, the term itself, so Kievan Rus is a modern term. And it's just a term that's used to distinguish like one historical period versus another. The modern definition, like that you would see in a like a history book or
I guess like a popular
definition. Yeah, an encyclopedia is that. It's a state that was established in the 10th century by the princes of the Rurikid dynasty that eventually was conquered by the Mongols and divided it into a bunch of smaller, tiny states. But there's a lot of debate on whether this was something that was real or not. And also, you know, again, these terms were invented in, you know, the age of nationalism, so the 19th and 20th century. I read a paper recently by, it was from St. Petersburg University. It was, I think it was translated from Russian to English, so it's not perfect. But it's from a AU Jernovinko. Kievan Rus is an artificial scholarly term for the first centuries of the history of the East Slavs, approximately 9th or 8th to the beginning of the 13th centuries. Historians begin to comprehend this period as integral, united, important, and differ from the others periods only at the beginning of the 20th century. And what he's saying is that, you know, this is... The Kievan Rus is a modern construct. There was never anyone calling themselves the Kievan Rus in the 10th century or the 11th century. There wasn't this national consciousness that existed. And a lot of times stories like this, or a lot of times ancient histories, because everyone wants an ancient history, like right. Everyone wants an origin story.
Mm-hmm.
They are Sounds used familiar. To create some type of national identity,
right?
Or national like linear story, like right. Having a linear story is very convenient for like
they
a
want
state
cohesion
national narrative.
They don't like plot holes, you know.
Yeah, they want to be able to be like, we are the descendants of these people,
the Scythians.
We are the direct descendants of this people. Usually when someone says that they're the direct descendants of an ancient people, usually Well, it's not true.
You're a Sarmatian and I'm a sea people. So
exactly.
We learned this through our studies.
Yes. But a couple episodes ago, when we were talking about the conflict right now in Ukraine, we were talking about the Tribune People thesis. And this is something that Putin believes. It is the belief that all Eastern Slavs, so Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, are one overarching community.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're all the descendants of one group of people, but they basically speak the same language. They're dialects that are different. So,
right.
You know, Ukrainian is just Russian, but it's just a different dialect.
Don't say that to Ukrainians.
I mean, I don't know the way to classify that stuff. I'm not in a position to do that, so I will not comment. One time I remember this was back in 2014, because it was right after Russia annexed Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
You ever go to a Bulgarian ice bar?
No, but I've heard of them.
So I went to a Bulgarian ice bar with a couple of my friends, and they had a Groupon where you went into an ice box,
mm-hmm.
you dressed up like a Soviet soldier,
and
you took as many
things.
Shots of vodka over like a 2-minute period.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very funny thing. So you went into the ice box, and then you took as many shots as possible. It was fun. One of my friends...
Wait, is that where they like beat you with those Leafs, or is that like their... That's the spa thing.
They don't know. That's a Russian bathhouse.
Ah, my bad. I'm confusing the two.
When we walk out, my buddy is like, "Yeah, let's go invade Ukraine." The guys who owned it weren't they weren't Bulgarian. They were Ukrainian.
Oh shit!
They threw us out because my friend made that comment. But yeah, I wouldn't make that mistake. I'm sensitive. I'm PC.
You're woke.
Identity politics in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm woke.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is the belief that they're all three are the same. You know, they're the same people and they just have different dialects. But the problem with that is that with the emergence of nations like Ukraine and Belarus in the 20th century, it broke the monopoly on, you know, the all-Russian historical account into separate histories of each nation. And all these national histories hold the Kievan Rus as the common starting point. What presenting this state does, it gives the illusion that at one time there was this national consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
There was this, you know, this shared ethno-cultural background that stems back from the 10th century, which it's just so murky. Like, how do you trace back your lineage that far? There's so
it's
much
like
that
all
can
of
happen.
Humankind like saying that we were all, you know, the same monkey community, you know, like you know, way back 200,000 years ago or whatever, we were all one monkey community. Like,
I know
it, like that's what it feels like, you know. It's like, yeah, sure, you know, like we all have a shared, you know, starting point, but like, to what extent, one, were the people then aware of the fact that they were one cohesive community, if in fact they were one cohesive community at all? And also, you know, how
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
How accurately can you trace that lineage throughout time? Like, the farther back you go, the harder it is, right? So how accurately can you trace that lineage where you can confidently say that this is, you know, like a truthful representation of the, you know, the historical record or you know, of your culture's origin story, you know? So it just becomes really murky, like you said, you know?
Most people don't know, at least most Americans. I know some people have like these family books where they trace their families really, really far back. Most Americans are
I'm pretty
not
jealous
like that.
Of that, by the way, to be honest.
I don't know. Very few
yeah.
Americans are like that.
Like if you know your family's coat of arms and you're not like English right now, I'm jealous. Like, that's not a thing that I get to know.
Most Americans don't know their great grandparents' first name.
Yeah, I don't know my great grandparents' first names.
I know mine because I just know my great grandfather was Thomas. Because his father was Thomas and everyone his son was Thomas, so I only know
they made
one
it
of
easy
my
for you, right? They all have the same name.
But yeah, most people I can't trace back my family heritage really anywhere. We were talking about this when we were doing our episode on our series on Japan, and we talked about the concept of the imagined community by Benedict Anderson. And, you know, this is a nation is imagined because it's possible for members of a nation to, because it's not possible for members of a nation to know all of the other nations. However, in their minds, they live in the same community. So it's a construct. Like, if you break this down to a more micro level, like we use the example of like what school you go to or what college you go to. You know, let's just say if you go to Penn State or something like that, or Danny, in your case, Rutgers, there's no way that you know every single student in that community. There's no way that you will know every single person in your undergraduate class, yet you're still like the Penn State community or the Rutgers
Knights.
Community yeah. or the Knights community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Penn State's case, you know, that community is so strong that you guys still venerate Joe Paterno. You guys are fine with him turning a blind eye to Sandusky.
Yeah.
Molesting a child.
Yeah,
that's how far that's how far that community goes.
That's how far nationalism goes, bro.
Penn State is I feel like there's something in the water there. People are extra weird about going to Penn State at Penn State. They're like, "Oh man, I went to Penn State. I only hire Penn State alumni." This theory emerges around like the 19th, early 20th century. You know, this theory about, you know, everyone coming from the same origin. But it's not really until World War II it was formulated by scholars for the purpose of really just wartime patriotism and, mm-hmm. and like anti-German sentiment, which brings another issue that we didn't even discuss yet. The first Kievan princes had Scandinavian names.
Right.
They're not Slavic names.
Which is super awkward when you consider that they were using this Kievan Rusing, you know, idea as a way to like stir up anti-German sentiment.
Well, every single textbook or history book that you read on this topic is going to probably have a chapter on something called the Varangian controversy. Right. And the Varangian controversy was the question of whether the first Kievan princes were either Germanic, so Varangian, or Russian or East Slavic. So there's like, there's always been this debate going back, you know, a long time, you know, who were the original founders, the state creators. Were it the Vikings, essentially, when we say the Scandinavians, because the Vikings were, you said it earlier, the Vikings were in that network of trade through the river system, and they had, you know, they were key stakeholders in the creation of the state.
100%, yeah. And I think that part is super wild. I think like the short version of the story goes that the Vikings tended to trade all over the place, like you said, and the place that made the most money at the time was, you know, the Slavic land. eventually they took.
And this was a big city compared to other medieval.
It was the biggest city, arguably. Yeah.
Yeah, it was about the size of Paris at the time, so it was bigger than London. It was a big city, mainly because of the trade networks it had with the Eastern Roman Empire.
Exactly. Exactly. And no, it sat, like I said, in the middle of between the Viking domain and the Eastern Roman domain. You know, so it just happened to be like a very rich place, and like Vikings tend to go take over places that are rich, like that's just their MO. And I mean, eventually the Slavic people defeated the Vikings, like they kicked them out. And then the Slavs started fighting against themselves for some reasons. And then this is where the story gets super weird. The Slavs figured that they were better off with like the Vikings as rulers. So they invited them back. It's super weird, dude. It feels like the Never Trumpers who were like beginning to like ask for the George Bush types of the world to come back to the forefront when Trump took office, you know? It's just weird. It's weird.
So I actually think I have the quote of what you're saying. Let me pull that up. But what you're talking about is the Primary Chronicle.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Primary
Chronicle. What we know about the Kievan Rus today is based primarily on the account of its history, the Primary Chronicle, which was like the earliest Rus historical narrative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't know who wrote this. It's like the Bible. It was most likely the work of a number of editors over time.
It was the Wikipedia of its day.
It was the Wikipedia of its time. So it was a lot of different voices in there. And according to the Primary Chronicle, once upon a time, there was a group of Slavic and Finno-Ugric or Ugric tribes.
Finno-Wetic?
Finnish and Estonia and that region. Hmm. And this coalition of tribes overthrew the Varangian rulers. The new government that they set up implodes. There's a vacuum.
Right.
A power vacuum. And
power vacuum.
You know, there's all sorts of problems with, you know, administrating the city. And
administrating droughts. The land bridge between Eastern Roman Empire and the Vikings.
Yeah, there's all sorts of issues, and their society collapses.
Right.
That's the narrative in the Primary Chronicle. There's famine, there's droughts, the civil war breaks out.
Right.
I mean, I was looking at the history, like I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but the history of that place was more likely just like a series of towns with wealthier towns with princes who used to go to war with each other a lot.
Right.
But what ends up happening, and according to the Primary Chronicle, is, sounds like a good album name, right? Primary Chronicle.
Yeah.
What they end up doing is they go back to the Varangians and they're like, hey, how about coming back? You know, it would be like if the U.S.
Let's get the band back together.
If the U.S. was, after the Revolutionary War, 10 years later, they were like, hey, can we get back in this empire, in this British Empire?
Yeah, that was fun.
But here's the quote I wanted to read, because this is directly from the Chronicle. They accordingly went overseas to the Varangian
Wait, am I reading the right one? Yes, this is.
Yeah,
so they accordingly went overseas to the Varangian Rus. These particular Varangians were known as Rus, just as some are called Swedes and other Normans, English, and Gotlanders, for they were thus named. The Chud, the Slovenians, the Krivichians, and the Vestans said to the people of Rus, "Our land is great and rich, but there is no order in it. Come to rule and reign over us." They thus selected three brothers within their kinfolk who took with them all of the Rus and migrated.
So, like, all of the Slavs were subs? They're like, "Oh, daddy, come and make me submit to you." It's like a weird, it reads like a BDSM manga or some shit like that. It's weird.
I mean, does it sound legit?
No, not exactly. You know, so like based on what you're saying and based on what I'm reading, it's these Varangians, you know, the Viking rulers, you know, were just invited to come marry them, come like rule them again, and then they intermarried with the Slavs or something. I don't know. It seems sus. Seems very sus.
I guess the purpose of this story is that by choosing their own rulers, it now became a legitimate union.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than like a slave master or like an overlord type relationship.
So does that mean if you're in an abusive relationship and then you invite them back, it makes it okay? You know, like how does that work?
I imagine, yeah, that would be a way that you would justify it. Weird. Now, I read this book called The Ethnic Origins of Slav. But it's by Serhii Plokhii. Serhii Plokhii?
Serhii Plokhii. I don't know.
Serhii Plokhii. You know, I'm Polish myself, and I suck at pronouncing anything that's just not straight American or English or Anglo. Anything that's not Anglo in nature, I cannot pronounce for shit, for shite. I'm better at pronouncing Middle Eastern words than fucking Eastern European words.
Keep at it, man. You'll get there.
Yeah. Does it really matter? Do I have to?
You know what I mean. You know the thing.
Yeah, no,
as Biden thing. Says.
Yeah. Well, you know, like the 2% thing. 2% of the people are upset. But yeah. So let me read this quote from this book I read. So, we know perfectly well that whatever problems former subjects encounter, they do not go back to their former overlords voluntarily. It is well established fact that Varangians penetrated the Finno-Ugric or Ugric and East Slavic territories by military conquest, not by invitation. While the episodes of choosing the faith and creating the Slavic alphabet find parallels in other literary traditions, should we then reject these legendary legends entirely? By no means. Apart from the possibility that they reflect elements of historical reality, they represent a unique source for the study and understanding of what we may call the hybrid identity of the Rus elites. And just going back, when to give that more context, when he says the alphabet and stuff like that. Earlier in the book, he was writing that, you know, there was, you know, conflicting stories about how the Rus adopted the alphabet from Eastern,
right,
from the Eastern from the Roman Eastern Empire, mm-hmm. and also Christianity, because there's right. just a lot of contradictions within it. But
right.
just to give you a sense, they adopted this area had a higher rate of literacy because they lived closer to the Eastern Roman Empire, and they actually had their a much longer literary history than other parts of Europe because of that. You know, they had their alphabet and they were writing, because most this was still early in Europe after the Roman Empire, well, the Western Roman Empire fell,
right?
And a lot of countries were illiterate,
right?
Or most people were illiterate and didn't really have a literary tradition.
One thing I found super interesting about that quote was that hybrid identity idea. I find that super fascinating because like you were said, when you look at some of those early stories of the Kievan Rus, it's, and you have to like think of its duality, right? There's this element of like this Viking ancestry, right? So it's no surprise that, you know, a lot of the early economic activity of the Kievan Rus involved raiding, right? Because that's what Vikings do. So there was a lot of stories about them being kind of like savage. And those were honestly coming mostly from Greeks and Romans who were, you know, full of shit and just didn't like different people very much. But like some of it was warranted because like there was the one time that they raided Constantinople. That was a thing, right? But the whole savagery bit isn't the only story either, right? The Viking part of the story isn't the whole side of the story, because the other side of the coin is like, it shows how the Byzantines ended up conquering the Rus, not militarily, but with culture. So the Rus were totally into like the latest fashion of Constantinople. They loved the clothes and things like that. You mentioned earlier the Cyrillic alphabet, right? So that it's based heavily on the
Greek. It's like backwards alphabet. Yeah.
It's like backwards R, backwards P, or whatever. it's based actually probably on the Greek from the Byzantines. That story is heavily argued as well, so I won't get too deep into that. And like you also said, you mentioned Christianity too, right? So that was another import from, you know, from the south, from the Byzantines. So it's definitely interesting to think about. The hybrid identity idea is more than likely the truest, the closest to the truth that I think is out there right now, which is that it wasn't exclusively one thing. You know, as much as you know, Slavic people would love to have one cohesive, very clear cut, you know, explanation, I think it's much more nuanced than that. And I think geographically speaking, where they were sitting, you know, they were subjected to a whole lot of influence from a whole lot of places. So I think and I think that's cool. I think that's cooler than just being like, oh no, we're just Slavic people, or oh no, we're just Vikings. You know, I think it's cooler to be, you know, this like melting pot of all this awesome stuff and that created an awesome, you know, some of the biggest cities of the time. That's cool to me. I think that's more real than the weird stories that they're trying to tell themselves.
Well, here's a quote, another quote I took from the same paper. Our contemporary historical knowledge convinces us that Kievan Rus is our antiquity. And we have our antiquity as the Western Europeans have theirs. And in this sense, it belongs to the, I told you this was translated kind of weird, it belongs to the all countries, and I repeat once more, not a separate country. The Kievan Rus is our pride and joy. There is no state there, no nationality, no stable religion and church, but it had high culture, freedom, and much good.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand that we cannot lengthen the history of contemporary countries of the post-Soviet space at the expense of Kievan Rus. In this sense, the history of West European countries is longer and their antiquity older than ours. Our states are comparatively young, but our antiquity is our great pride and not just the object of clashes and historical wars. And this was a really interesting paper that I read. Despite, you know, there's some translation issues, it was, you know, it's readable and it's worth giving a read. I'll post this in the link as well. But what this paper kind of points out is that most of the history of the Kievan Rus was a product of just the nation building process. Like it was, most of it was part of the nation building process. And
mm-hmm.
you know what he, I think this guy might be a Marxist too. He was saying that, like you didn't need to exaggerate that it was a state, because like there was already high culture going on. There's enough evidence of high culture going on there.
Yeah,
so
I mean that definitely does sound very Marxist though. No state, no nationality, no stable religion, no church, but culture, freedom, and good. You know, that definitely sounds a bit communist flavor. But you're right though. I think it's a fascinating idea that Mr. DiGiorno is pointing out there.
Well, there was a line in this essay that was like, you know, remember Marx himself, he did hate Slavs. he didn't like Slavics,
mm-hmm.
but we forgive him. Like it was like a line of something, unless I misread it. I'll post it in here.
I don't have the actual article up besides this quote, but it was interesting. It was just like an interesting read because it's from a Russian source rather than, you know, an American writing on it. So it's nice to get that, you know, different perspective. But just going back, it's all these nations are just these constructs that were created, you know, like going back into like the 1400s or 1500s. All right, I'll give you a good example of this because I'm kind of flying off the I'm having trouble articulating this right now. If you watch the show The Last Kingdom, which I always talk about on this show,
yeah,
it is really entertaining. It's kind of cheesy and corny at the same time, but I enjoy it. I think it's a really fun show. But there's this, the story is about like the Saxons and the Danes fighting each other in England in the 9th century, in the 9th and 10th century. And
around
the same time as this. And Uhtred is like this badass like Saxon who was kidnapped by the Danes when he was a child and then raised as a Dane. And then he goes back to fight with the Saxons, and he's like he's the Dane Slayer. He's working with Alfred the Great, who is a real king. And in this show, they keep on saying, we need to fight for Alfred's idea of an England, because there's no England at this time. So the last kingdom is Wessex. They're the last kingdom not to be conquered by the Danes. And then, you know, next to them is Mercia, and then there's Wallis, like Wales, and East Anglia. So there's all these other different kingdoms there. And Alfred's goal in life, and he keeps on stressing this, is like, the idea of an England. There will be an idea of an England. He wants to unite all the different English kingdoms together and create the idea of an England. It sounds corny when they talk about it, because I doubt that they were thinking that in that way. Like, my idea of one cohesive England. Maybe they were. Maybe I'm just completely wrong. But maybe just my skepticism on popular history is that
I think
that
a lot of it is, I think you're getting at something, because a lot of it is hindsight 2020, right? I think in the moment, they're not, like, just even using the word England is kind of like wild to me, in the same way that, you know, we use the word Kievan Rus to describe the society that we've been having the show about. That is a word that we ascribe to them now, right? But when they were thinking about unifying the lands, I don't think that they had a name in mind, or even that they had like a cohesive culture or like national identity in mind. They just had the idea that, hey, let's all get together, right? Either because it's economically better, or because, you know, for military reasons, it would be better to be unified, or just because you have the urge to dominate, you know, and that's it. But it's usually among a very select few people, right? We're talking about like the elites, the kings, the queens, the princes, things like that. You know, those are the ones with the ruminations, with the machinations to unify England in that case, or, you know, to create a great, you know, Kievan Rus, right? But, you know, is that community real? Is the question. Was that community at the time real? Did they all consider themselves as a part of the same community, a part of the same identity? The answer is probably no, right?
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can spend less time staying in the know about all things gaming and get more time to actually play the games you love with the IGN Daily Update podcast. All you need is a few minutes to hear the latest from IGN on the world of video games, movies, and television with news, previews, and reviews. You'll hear everything from Comic-Con coverage to the huge Diablo 4 launch. So listen and subscribe to the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts. That's the IGN Daily Update wherever you get your podcasts.
Probably not at the time.
You have much more at that time period, I would imagine. You have much more unity with your local, like, town.
Right.
Your local village. There's probably way, you probably, like, each village had their very own distinct culture.
Right.
Even their distinct dialect.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have mass media.
Right.
Or mass papers. Like, we didn't have the printing press to, like, they weren't able to mass produce a type of medium that everyone could follow along.
And maybe they had some shared experiences, right? Like, you know, their shared experience might be that, you know, from town to town, they were both ruled by the same ruler and they both had to pay the taxes to the same, you know, sovereign. So those things might have created like this, some like quasi sense of community, like, oh shit, we got to pay the man, you know? But like outside of that, you know, even I would argue probably the differences between Kiev and, you know, Novgorod, that were two very large cities, were probably very fucking different communities at the time.
Yeah, they absolutely were. Like all of those like cities, because they're basically city states,
right,
in this like geographic area that, you know, we're experiencing wealth at this time, you know, right. What I mean?
But we call them today as one.
The Kiev and Rus, like, exactly. It's like some,
like, it was, you know, a thing.
Magical empire, right, back in the day that, right, you know, that you can trace some type of glory from.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that it's just interesting how these stories are always part of the nation building process. Like, they're used to build national cohesion. Like they're used to, you know, create the like a shared experience. And it's funny how this is all in collusion with the academics and the state. Like the state, mm-hmm, and the, yeah, historical societies work together to make these narratives.
To figure it
and that's
out.
What I find like the most amazing about these, mm-hmm, stories. And it's like for every country. Like it's not, right, just like, it's not like some,
it's not unique. It's like everyone's, not unique, doing it. Yeah.
Every nation had to do this to build that national unity. They had to get scholars to like read old text and, you know, go through, create like this national heritage with some type of legitimacy added to it. So there had to be some type of like archaeological dig and stuff like that. Like, oh, we, right, found the remains of a Flemish man here. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We found the remains of a Franks in the case of France. Like, so they have to like have some legitimacy to that process. But it's just interesting that there needs to be this process where where the government and, you know, the university system join each other to create this narrative that they plan on mass producing to their society in order to create a nation like that. I mean, that's how it starts. That's
I'm interested in that. I'm interested in that delivery method. I think that's the one piece that I haven't seen enough of. It's like, you know, how do they start delivering that? I also want to take this and blow this up a bit, because, you know, I like talking about aliens, and I'm thinking about aliens right now because, you know, I think about the Kievan Rus and I think about like how we're ascribing this idea, the idea of an England, the idea of a, you know, Kievan Rus at the time that probably didn't exist at the time. But because we're looking at back at it through the lens of history that we constructed for ourselves, I wonder if, let's say, in 1,000 years, you know, sometime between now and, you know, fuck it, 5,000 years. Let's really push it out there, right? 5,000 years from now, we're still alive somehow. you know, we survived the global warming crisis, and you know, eventually we find out that we are, you know, only one, you know, habitable planet with sentient life out of thousands of others in the galaxy, and you know, we join the galactic community, whether you know, through military or just, you know, through blind curiosity and science. And I think about how the historians then would look back on Earth today, and would they ascribe to us a type of like ancient Earth culture? Like they would call us like Earthlings, and they would make these like, you know, nationalist, or nationalist wouldn't be the word, would it? Because we'd be talking about globalist. Let's call it globalist.
Would it be globalist? It would be I guess globalist.
Globalist would work, but in a very, we're not talking about the globalists here. I'm talking about literally the word globalist, like nationalist as an example.
I think it would still apply if the nation,
the nation is the globe.
You know? The nation is the globe. Or if the nation is the solar system, or the nation is like your
planetist,
your planet, you know, your
the nation
planets
is planet
that you colonized.
But so I think about that, right? And I think about how would the historians then try to bridge the many gaps that we have with one another, you know, and make pretend that we all had this kind of, you know, unifying, you know, Earthling.
Well, now would be the time to write that story. This period, right now, where we're at, would be like, there's no other time in like global history where there's been just one power.
Right. This is where you would start the story, right?
Like
this is where the story gets murky.
There's never been just one hegemony ever in world history.
Right.
Like even the Romans, even the time of the Roman Empire, like they weren't unstoppable, obviously. Right. Even
and
at
there was
height.
Also massive Chinese empire. There was massive like Native American empires, you know.
I mean the Roman Empire couldn't really like stretch too far, you know, once they went out to like the steppe, for example,
they
circled us back to the steppe, you know, they wouldn't really be able to last that long, you know. I mean, it's just hard for an empire to keep on marching and marching and marching, and like having your arm, like they can go up to Northern Europe and, you know, beat up some barbarians, but going over to the steppe fighting the horse lords was always an issue for them, especially because like the further you go out, you know, the thinner your supply lines get, and all that.
You could say the same thing about like space, right? Like we couldn't extend our empire that very far into space, you know, because we're just like a little fledgling thing, you know, but it would start now, wouldn't it? Like that.
Well, the story would start now, because right now it'd be like the American planet. Like, it's like the great, because we're planet America right now.
Yeah, kind of.
It's planet America. They may as well just call it Planet America.
You ever hear that song by Rammstein, America? We're all living in America. It's a cool song. Good video.
Planet America, the United States government will nuke a country before it gives up that hegemony.
It already
It would absolutely it already has, but it'll do it again.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. used to threaten. They don't really. The U.S. doesn't threaten people with nukes that much anymore.
They don't have
to.
Because
the 50s.
Yeah.
In the 50s and 60s, the U.S. used to threaten everyone with nuking. Like, we'll nuke you. We'll nuke you.
Say something else.
Say something else.
Say what again,
what?
Motherfucker.
When Iraq tried to nationalize their oil, they threatened to nuke them in the 50s. Like, we're going to nuke you if you do that. And they're like,
say
okay,
what again?
We're joking. We're joking. We're not going to do that.
Yeah, man. So we'd be Planet America. It's settled. The you know, the alien historians from 5,000 years from now will dig into the, you know, ancient archives of the interweb. And they would clearly see our culture dominated and was pervasive throughout the entire world. You know, they would come across a podcast called Bro History. And they'd be like, wow, look, this is like the ancient historians of the time Look, they chronicled everything for us in a way that's easy for us aliens to understand.
What if, like, we become like the subjects in ancient history, and they come back and they master time travel,
and they come and back to us?
They come
back. Oh, jeez.
For some reason.
To Henry and Danny
to bring us into the future, to create some type of time loop that's necessary for it. Maybe that's what happened with this podcast. Hey, H.G. Lovecraft didn't know that he was writing these mega hits when he was writing them, and look at him now. He's dead without getting famous before all his big hits came out.
So are you trying to say that we're not going to blow up as a podcast until we die?
Well, we're partially blown up.
Yeah, I guess so. Right? Yeah,
we have a decent listener base. We're no Joe Rogan, but who is? We're
not even Joe Rogan's Joe Rogan anymore.
I know. We're no Cumtown. That's another famous podcast, right? Well, in time.
In 5,000 years they'll be looking back at us and being like, yeah. Those awesome historians from planet America.
You guys aren't historians. You guys aren't historians. What the fuck? These guys say they're historians. What the fuck?
You guys don't know what you're talking about.
What the fuck?
Read a book, man.
What the fuck, man?
Learn how to pronounce things before you call yourself a historian.
What the fuck, man? Put it in the pronounce. Put it on pronounce.com. What the fuck? How are you going to talk about this shit? Can't even pronounce fucking, like, a traditional fucking Ukrainian name. Fuck you.
You know, it's funny because, like, everyone is getting into... I'll end with this. We'll keep this in the show. It's a little gripe. It's funny, though. So everyone's, like, getting into, like, political debates online. Like, oh, like, either a bunch of, like, people on the left attack somebody or, you know, vice versa or whatever. Like, you know, people are getting into these kind of vicious right-left dichotomy type arguments based off their views. For us, we don't get any of that. Like, very rarely does, like, a left-winger or a right-winger comes after us. It's always, like, somebody who's like, what the fuck, man? You didn't talk about this tribe? Like, you didn't talk about, like, the fucking... like, or they'll come up to us and be like, hey, thanks for talking about those sleazy Tigray. Like, it'll just be something intensely kind of like, what the fuck? Like, we weren't talking... saying that the Tigray people should die. That wasn't where we were getting at when we were talking about the Ethiopia episode. Like, it really wasn't. We weren't. I'm glad you liked the show, but we weren't.
Yeah.
We weren't agreeing with any type of genocide. And they're like, oh, the Tigray should die. I'm like, that wasn't really the point. We were just trying to make a point that there was an issue with.
They were having problems, okay?
They were having problems up there. We weren't going to go that far. But yeah, or we'll get it from... I used to get it a lot with pro-Syrian, Free Syrian Army people.
Yeah.
Like 2 years ago, like a year and a half ago. Those are the type of things I get attacked by.
I would get it from the folks that think I had Trump derangement syndrome, even though, you know, it's like, clearly I don't have that, and... That's not the entire show either, because you definitely don't have it, you know?
I don't know. I think if you listen to an entire episode and you think that we have Trump's derangement syndrome, I think you just have...
You just have listening problems.
You need to fucking relax. All right. We're just not even talking about anything anymore. We should probably end this.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you guys for listening to another episode of Bro History. Sorry, that went off the rails at the end, but it is late as hell. It's 11:30 p.m. right now. And honestly, I'm falling asleep while we're talking on the mic right now. So make sure that you rate and review the podcast. Rate and review. It is the number one way to help us grow our show. Click on right in the top right-hand corner. The other thing you could do is you can join us on Patreon. My inner Joe Biden.
Dr. Steve Brule, Preetza. Patreon. You can join us on Patreon, and you will get access to additional content. You will also get access to our Slack account where we talk and shoot the shit, and it's a good, fun way to communicate. So, yeah, rate, review, support us on Patreon, you know, whatever you guys want. We love you, and make sure that you tune in next week. Peace.
Peace.
Hey guys, just want to give you a quick heads up that the following week we're not going to be able to record another episode. So the next episode that's going to be launched from Bro History will be 2 weeks from now instead of next week. We always try to get an episode out every single week. Unfortunately, schedules are just too crazy right now, so it's not going to work out. But we appreciate you bearing with us, and we look forward to releasing our next episode in 2 weeks from now. Hope you guys enjoy the rest of your day, and peace.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.